Welcome to the Fitness to Dive podcast. I am Dr. David Charish. I am a dive medicine physician, board certified in emergency medicine and undersea and hyperbaric medicine. A question every diver should ask themselves prior to any dive is, am I fit to dive? As a hyperbaric physician and diving consultant, I work with the diving community to evaluate and treat diving-related issues. As an educator, I offer lectures, workshops, seminars, and symposium on all aspects of dive safety, dive technology, and dive medicine. A question every diver should ask themselves prior to any dive is, am I fit to dive? Understanding what constitutes fitness to dive is key to our ability to process this information and allow for effective decision making. In a real-world example, as a diver, with a dive trip scheduled and now with a new medical diagnosis and recently prescribed medication, what information do you need to both absorb this information about your medical condition and have the cognitive ability to make an informed decision? We will have conversations with leaders in the fields of dive safety, dive technology, dive medicine, and most importantly, divers. These podcasts will explore the many aspects of fitness to dive. We can better understand our fitness to dive as we address these six areas: medical fitness, psychological fitness, nutrition, physical fitness, knowledge, and physical skill. So whether you are a recreational diver, technical diver, public safety diver, scientific diver, commercial diver, military diver, or free diver, understanding your fitness to dive will make your diving safer and more enjoyable. Please join me on this important conversation on fitness to dive. This is Dr. David Charish, dive medicine physician of Dive Medicine and Hyperbaric Consultants. A key concept to our understanding of medical fitness in diving is that diving can lead to the deterioration of the medical condition. That medical condition can present an increased risk for the diving injury to both the individual and the diving partner. Today we will have a conversation about heart fitness in diving. I am grateful that cardiologist and technical diving instructor Dr. Douglas Ebersole has been kind enough to speak with us today. Dr. Ebersole, thank you for joining the conversation on heart health on this episode of Fitness and Diving.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
So, Dr. Ebersole, help me understand, what are the cardiac risk factors?
Okay, well, cardiac risk factors, first off, we have to understand that these are risk factors and not requirements. So basically, they increase your risk of developing heart disease, but they're not requirements. So people that don't even have these can still develop cardiac conditions. The strongest predictor of developing heart disease is simply age, which we cannot obviously control. However, the modifiable risk factors would include hypertension, diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, so high cholesterol, and smoking. Then non-modifiable things would be, again, advancing age and family history.
So how do they impact our heart health?
Well, each of these make us more likely to develop cardiac conditions, especially coronary artery disease, so the things that put people at risk for heart attacks and requiring stents and bypass surgery and so forth. They're also risk factors for development of congestive heart failure and for developing stroke.
Okay, and so how do these cardiac risk factors potentially affect our fitness to diving?
Well, that's the whole thing. So again, we need to be physically fit to dive. So if these risk factors have led to, let's say, a heart attack or led to congestive heart failure or a stroke, the results of that condition may make you no longer able to dive.
Great. So now that we have an understanding of cardiac risk factors, let's explore other conditions that might affect our fitness to dive. A statistic in diving none of us wish to be associated with is a diving fatality. We see that there is an association with both physical fitness and underlying cardiac disease as an influence on these diving fatalities. Throughout our conversation today, we will explore a number of heart-related conditions that can contribute to diving fatalities. Dr. Ebersole, let's explore for a moment physical fitness and exercise capacity. Why is physical fitness such an important issue in diving?
Well, in general, scuba diving should not require a lot of exertion. In fact, I jokingly tell my patients that are diving students that if you are getting fit by scuba diving, you're doing scuba diving wrong. You should be fit for diving, not use scuba diving to become fit. But while it normally doesn't take a lot of effort to scuba dive, you can find yourself in conditions where you've got a problem, such as, you know, you're swimming, you're wearing heavy gear, you've got increased work or breathing from regulators, and then all of a sudden you surface into a rough seas, or you have a strong current, you're a long ways from the boat, And unlike other activities, like if you were, let's say, jogging or playing tennis and started having a problem, you would just stop those activities. However, if you're drifting away from the boat or trying to fight a current, you're going to continue to exert yourself and possibly get yourself into trouble if you had some sort of underlying condition.
That makes a lot of sense. And so when we think about then what is an acceptable degree of physical fitness, it also depends on the kind of diving you are doing or the kind of diver you are. So a technical diver requiring a greater degree of physical fitness than a recreational diver in warm waters without any heavy equipment, I suppose.
Exactly. So if you're a warm water recreational diver, that's very little effort, obviously. If you're a cold water diver and doubles in dry suits and heavy surf and cold water and so forth, that's a lot more exertion. And also if you're a diving professional where you're not responsible just for yourself, but responsible for students and so forth, you would need to be at a higher level of fitness.
Great. So from a cardiologist perspective, how do you assess physical fitness?
Okay. So first off, what we do is with stress testing, a usual protocol is what's called a Bruce protocol stress test. That's what we use generally in cardiology. And I'll give you that stress test. I'll give you the exact numbers for the listeners in case they want to see what kind of fitness they have. Because if you're at a gym, you can run a Bruce protocol. It's fairly straightforward. Stage one, and these are 3-minute protocols. Stage one, you're at 1.7 miles per hour with a 10% grade. Stage two, 3 minutes later, then goes to 2.5 miles per hour with a 12% grade. Stage three is 3.4 miles per hour with a 14% grade. And then stage four is 4.2 miles per hour at a 16% grade. And these correlate to various METs. And what a MET is a metabolic unit, which for any of the science geeks that are out there, is 3.5 milliliters of oxygen per kilogram per minute consumption. Basically, is just kind of sitting here resting. So like you and I talking are probably going about one MET or this 3.5 milliliters of oxygen. It's felt that if you are less than your maximum is less than 5 METs, that's felt to be poorly conditioned. Somewhere in the 5 to 8 range is felt to be fair condition. 9 to 11 is good, and more than 12 is excellent. And I bring that up because in the past, based on some exercise physiology numbers, Fred Beauvais, who is a former president of the American College of Cardiology and a known diving medicine expert who passed away a few years ago, he had always said that you needed to be able to achieve 13 METs of activity to scuba dive. And that was based on some exercise physiology numbers. However, if you correlate that back to the Bruce protocol I was talking about a couple of minutes ago, that would be the equivalent of going up to around 12 minutes or so on a Bruce protocol, which I will guarantee you that 90% of scuba divers out there will never be able to do. 4.2 miles per hour is, for someone who's tall or has long legs, they can walk that as long as you're walking it very fast. Other people are going to have to jog it, and you're jogging it at a 16% grade. So I'll tell you that, you know, I do treadmills all day some days, and very few people are hitting 12 METs. So that number has been revised, and now it's felt that if you can achieve about 7 METs of exercise, that's adequate for recreational diving. So 7 METs would be finishing 6 minutes on that protocol I was talking about earlier. So if you were able to go at 2.5 miles per hour at a 12% grade, that's about 7 METs of activity. So if you go to the gym and go to that kind of level, kind of a fairly brisk walk, that's probably adequate for most scuba diving activities. That correlates to kind of in between, kind of right around bicycling or playing singles tennis. Those kind of it.
Let's talk about hypertension. How do we define hypertension?
Okay. Hypertension is one of those things that those of us in medicine look a little schizophrenic over the years because previously we always defined hypertension as a blood pressure of 140 millimeters mercury over 90 millimeters mercury, so kind of 140 over 90. But what you have to realize is it's not a dichotomous variable like that. It's not like 138 over 88 is low risk and 142 over 92 is high risk. It's just a matter of where you draw the line in the sand. So if we as a culture in a country decided we were only going to treat blood pressure that was 200 over 140, okay, we would save a lot of medication costs for the country, but we'd have a lot of people dying of strokes and heart attacks. On the other hand, if we decided we were going to treat everybody to a blood pressure of 100 over 60, we would probably avoid lots of heart attacks, avoid lots of strokes, but we'd also probably bankrupt everybody trying to, cover the cost of all these medicines.
Sure.
So currently, there's been a revision in the hypertension guidelines. Currently, it's accepted that normal blood pressure is 120 over 80 or lower. Elevated blood pressure is considered to be 120 to 129 over less than 80. And then they group hypertension into two categories. Stage one normally would have been normal. Stage one is 130 to 139 over 80 to 89, so less than 140 over 90. And those people we don't put on medications unless they have either have had a prior event or they have some very high risk factor like chronic kidney disease or diabetes. But let them know that they're kind of pre-hypertension and you need to watch diet, exercise, and so forth. And then stage two would be over the usual 140 over 90.
And so what are some of the short and long-term effects of uncontrolled hypertension?
Well, the problem with hypertension is it's considered to be the silent killer because it doesn't cause any symptoms. And in the past, thankfully not now, but in the past, a lot of the medicines we used to treat hypertension made people feel bad. So we wondered why they didn't take their medicine. They were feeling fine. And now we give them medicine, make them feel like crap, so they stopped taking it. But the problem is with uncontrolled hypertension where you have no symptoms of things, long-term, it puts you at a very high risk of heart attacks, again, congestive heart failure, and stroke. So all those things are very high risk if you have uncontrolled hypertension for a long time.
So I can see as a diver why I would want to be concerned then on addressing my uncontrolled hypertension or hypertension in general.
Correct, because the problem with hypertension is it's going to be a problem 10 years from now, 20 years from now, or later. So you may be in your 30s or 40s and say, well, I'm not going to worry about this. It's not that big of a deal. And then you find yourself unable to be scuba diving in your 60s and 70s after you had that heart attack that you weren't planning on having.
And then assuming that you have appropriate medical direction, what are the possible treatment options for hypertension?
Okay. Again, for that, you know, early kind of pre-hypertension stage one would be diet, exercise, and sodium restriction to try and see if we can get you to a good level without starting medications. However, we do have very good medications for hypertension these days. Most of the time, what we'll start with is either what's called an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, an angiotensin receptor blocker. That's usually the first line, or a calcium channel blocker. If those at maximum doses are ineffective at getting to goal, we'll add the one that we didn't start with the first time, so you end up on both of them. And then we'll occasionally add a diuretic as a third medication. The reason I bring all that up is if you have true hypertension, it's very common to require two or three medications because hypertension is not a single problem and we have to attack it oftentimes from multiple directions. So if you find your doctor putting you on two or three medications, that's not that unexpected and not that uncommon. So I wouldn't get overly worried about that. The key is getting that blood pressure controlled however we can get it controlled.
And then I guess potentially dangerous to a diver is uncontrolled hypertension that is not being addressed.
Correct, because you could have a couple of problems there. With the high blood pressure, you are going to be at risk for having a heart attack underwater, potentially. With high blood pressure, your left ventricle becomes quite stiff, and that's going to put you at risk for emergent pulmonary edema, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit later, and so forth. So all those things would potentially be bad in the water.
So am I correct in assuming that managing one's hypertension under medical supervision, this could decrease the risk of the diver?
Absolutely.
And then to be clear then, having controlled hypertension with appropriate medical management, one could be medically fit to dive.
Absolutely. If you need to be aware that probably in the United States, 50% of all adults over the age of 50 have hypertension. Okay, so it's a very common thing. It does not preclude you from diving. The key is just get it treated.
Absolutely. Thank you. And then if we could talk about the most prevalent life-threatening disease in the United States, coronary artery disease. We know that over 700,000 people die each year from coronary artery disease. We also know that regarding diving fatalities, that 30% of diving fatalities in divers greater than 50 years of age have an associated related cardiac issue or event. So what are the effects of diving on the heart?
Okay, well, first, obviously, is the stress, just like the physical stress. And that's because you're swimming, okay? So you've got the resistance of swimming as opposed to walking or go about your normal day-to-day activities. You've got weights, you know, you've got a lot of weight you're carrying on, the weight of your equipment, the drag in the water of the equipment, making resistance even more to the swimming. And then you've got this increased work of breathing from regulators and rebreathers and so forth. So all of that's going to put a larger degree of stress on the heart than would say just walking or some other activity. And like I mentioned before, you may or may not be able to simply stop your activity when you're diving, which you could normally do if you were topside. You know, you're playing tennis, have a problem, you stop. You may not be able to do that underwater. Additionally, part of the diving reflex when we put ourselves in water, even if you're just swimming, is we will fluid shift about 700 cc's of volume from our extremities into our central circulation, which puts additional stress on the heart. And if your heart were weak or your heart were stiff, this can result in pulmonary edema, you know, congestive heart failure, inability to breathe, and that can happen underwater.
Absolutely. So with coronary artery disease, then there's a narrowing of the artery surrounding the heart. And when the heart requires adequate blood flow to transport the necessary oxygen to support the demand of the heart is unable to meet the oxygen demand. Dr. Ebersole, what are some of the symptoms a diver may experience while on land or underwater with coronary artery disease?
Okay, the classic symptom of coronary artery disease is angina. The key is it's called chest pain, but most people would say it's actually not pain. Most of the time, if you have somebody, they'll say it really wasn't pain. They'll describe it kind of vaguely as a chest discomfort. It may be burning, it may be pressure, it may be a sense of fullness, but most people say it's not pain. So some discomfort with activity, usually in the chest, but can also be in the neck, the jaw, between the shoulder blades and so forth. That's the normal kind of symptoms that people will have. Other people will not have classic symptoms. Women, especially elderly women, do not have classic symptoms the way middle-aged or younger men do. So they may present with more of shortness of breath. All of these symptoms need to be aware that with coronary disease, they tend to last minutes. Pain that lasts seconds and resolves, or things that last hours and hours or days and days, is not going to be coronary disease. So an exertional discomfort of some sort lasting a few minutes and resolving with rest should be a red flag to be checked out for underlying coronary disease.
So if a diver is diagnosed with coronary artery disease, does that mean they can no longer dive?
Absolutely not. There are lots and lots of people with coronary artery disease diving every day. What happens is if you have coronary artery disease, whether it be just angina like we were talking about, whether it be you had a heart attack, whether it be you had heart stents or you had bypass surgery, what we look at is three things. One is, what is your underlying heart muscle function? Obviously, if your heart muscle function is weak, that would put you even at more risk of having heart failure from that fluid shift we were talking about earlier. So that is felt to be a contraindication to diving. If people have very poor exercise tolerance as a result of this, then they should not be diving because, again, they're putting themselves in a risky environment. And thirdly, if they have any active angina or active ischemia on a stress test, so abnormal blood flow to the heart, they should not be diving. But in general, if people, after they've had their event and they've been treated, whether it be with medications, stents, or bypass surgery, if they have normal heart muscle function, they have reasonable exercise tolerance, like we talked about earlier, so say around that 7 mets or so for recreational diving, and they have a treadmill that showed that 7 mets and also showed no evidence of any blockages still, they can return to diving with no restrictions.
Well, that's great to know because many of our divers are concerned about their inability to return to diving who have known coronary artery disease. Thank you. Dr. Ebersole, there is really useful information for our audience, so thank you so much. Let's talk about emergent pulmonary edema.
Okay.
So what is it?
Okay, emergent pulmonary edema is when a diver all of a sudden goes into congestive heart failure when placed in the water. This was initially reported in combat swimmers. So these were physically fit Navy divers. Oftentimes it was in cold water initially, and it used to be considered that was a requirement, which it is not. And what happens is that there'll be this immersion in water, which can be swimming or it could be scuba diving. And you get this fluid shift that we talked about earlier into the central circulation. And with that, people will overwhelm their heart's ability to handle that. And the fluid will then back up in the lungs, and they find themselves unable to breathe. This disorder can occur at any point in a dive. It can occur at the surface. It can occur during descent. It can occur on the bottom. It can occur during ascent, and it can occur once you're back on the surface after the dive. So the timing is not particularly helpful in kind of deciding what the illness is. Importantly, the treatment is getting the diver out of the water. Okay, it's not just getting them to the surface because it could still worsen while on the surface. You have to physically get the diver out of the water. It usually presents with shortness of breath or a cough. It does not usually present with chest pain, so that's helpful. So if someone describes breathlessness at some point during the dive and they appear to be in pulmonary edema with no chest discomfort, that helps make you think you're probably more likely to be looking at emergent pulmonary edema as opposed to a heart attack with congestive heart failure.
And are there any medical conditions or risk factors associated with those who present with emergent pulmonary edema?
Yes, about 50% of people with emergent pulmonary edema will be found to have some underlying cardiovascular problem. So anybody that's referred to me with emergent pulmonary edema gets a cardiac workup. That usually just includes an echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound test of the heart, to assess their overall heart muscle function, to look at the thickness of the heart. If you have high blood pressure for a long time, the heart muscle can get thick, just like your muscles will get thick if you're lifting weights all the time. And that thick heart muscle doesn't relax well and puts people at risk for pulmonary edema. And then they get a stress test to make sure there's no evidence of any underlying coronary artery disease. So pretty much everybody who presents who would be of age to have a problem should get an echocardiogram and a stress test with emergent pulmonary edema.
Great. And then tell me about the field treatment of emergent pulmonary edema. So you get them out of the water. What should we be doing on the boat or on the dive site when we have someone we think has emergent pulmonary edema?
Okay, first thing obviously is get them out of the water. Secondly is put them on 100% oxygen, just like you do for all diving accidents. So whether it's you're concerned about a heart attack, you're concerned about decompression illness, you're concerned about air gas embolism, you're concerned about emergent pulmonary edema, you put them on 100% oxygen. So you'd want to activate EMS, obviously, put them on 100% oxygen and get them out of the water. And most of the time, this will clear fairly quickly.
Right. And when they come to the emergency department, what is a typical treatment expected there?
Same thing. You can give people diuretics and so forth like you would for heart failure. But to be honest with you, the majority of these people will be very, very short of breath and maybe very sick at the scene. But oftentimes, by the time they get to the emergency department, their chest x-ray is already almost clear and they may be getting much better just with being out of the water and on oxygen. And that's also something that can kind of help lead you to think that this may be what's going on, the fact that it resolves so quickly.
Right. And then I suppose that in a somewhat thoughtful way, that emergent pulmonary edema sounds a little bit like pulmonary decompression sickness, shortness of breath while diving, coughing, difficulty in breathing. How do we distinguish one from the other?
Okay, well, obviously, pulmonary decompression illness would require some inert gas load, and then either ascending or be on the surface. So if this happens as somebody has surfaced, it can be confusing. However, if it happens at the beginning of the dive or happens during descent or happens on the bottom, that would be very unlikely to be pulmonary decompression illness, obviously, because you're not off-gassing. So that would be. And the other thing to be aware of emergent pulmonary edema is, returning to diving after that.
Right.
And the reason that's concerning is there's probably about a 15% recurrence rate, and we're not very good at predicting who that's going to be. I don't mean to scare people, but there have been isolated reports of that recurrence being a fatal event. So what I do with my patients is we have a heart-to-heart discussion if they've had emergent pulmonary edema about returning to diving, and it's how strongly they want to return to diving. And then kind of how do we deal with that? And a lot of that may be where they're going to dive and what kind of medical attention they could get to. In other words, if you're diving here in Florida, where there's easy medical care, you may want to take the risk of saying warm water diving, recreational stuff, I'll take my chances. You may not. But if you do, I strongly advise people not to do a lot of remote travel. I mean, if you've had recurrent emergent pulmonary edema, going to Raja Ampat on a liverboard, probably not in your best interest. Because
right.
If you were to have a problem, getting to medical care anytime quickly is going to be an issue for you.
Absolutely. Well, that's great information. Thank you. Dr. Ebersol, let's talk about Peyton-Frayman O'Valley. What is PFO or Peyton-Frayman O'Valley?
The way to think about this, and I know this is a podcast, it's easier to draw this, but I'll try to verbally describe it. When our heart is forming as a fetus, if everybody thinks back to biology class, your heart has four chambers. It has two on the top and two on the bottom. The wall between the two bottom chambers is a solid wall. However, the wall between the two top chambers is not. What happens is the wall will grow up from the bottom and grow down from the top. And the two walls as they're growing together don't actually meet. They overlap, which causes a little bit of a flap. And the reason for that is because when we're a fetus, our lungs are collapsed and full of fluid. The whole purpose of the right side of the heart is to pump blood to the lungs and get oxygen to then come back to the left side and get pumped to the body. Well, as a fetus, you've got these collapsed fluid-filled lungs. You're not using them. You're using the blood from the placenta. And the idea is, again, it's easier to show this visually, but if you've got this flap, the right side of the heart is now trying to pump this blood to these collapsed fluid-filled lungs. That's going to generate an increased resistance, increased pressure, and it pushes this flap open between the right and left atrium, and the blood from the placenta that's oxygenated will just go across the flap and basically bypass the right heart. So everyone has a PFO, when they're a fetus. That's normal. When we're born and we open up our lungs, well, now at this point, the resistance to blood going to the lungs is much lower compared to the left side, and this little flap gets slammed shut. In about 75% of people, that flap will seal in the first year of life and become a solid wall, which means, though, then in about 25% of people, it never quite closes, and you've got a little flap, which can get some people into trouble.
What kind of trouble do we get in as divers who have a PFO?
As a cardiologist, the number one thing we see with PFO as far as people getting into trouble is with a condition that's called cryptogenic stroke, which is basically strokes in young people who have no other real reason to have a stroke. And the feeling is that a microscopic clot that was coming up from the legs that would normally get filtered by the lungs can cross over this flap and cause a stroke. And that's where most of the data is in terms of treating PFO, is in this cryptogenic stroke population. For divers, as we know, we all will develop some level of bubbles with diving from inert gas. Usually nitrogen can be helium if you're diving trimix, but some level of venous bubbles will occur. But these venous bubbles are usually just filtered by the lungs. If you've got a PFO, however, as you get these venous bubbles, they can cross over that same little flap, end up on the left side of the heart, and get shot to the brain, the spinal cord, and so forth, and have symptoms of decompression illness.
So how do we evaluate for PFO?
The situation with PFO, first off, as best we can determine, the increased risk of having decompression illness with a PFO is about fivefold the non-PFO population. So your increased risk is about five times, which from a relative risk sounds scary. But what you have to do is look at the absolute risk, okay? So for recreational diving, the risk of decompression illness is somewhere around two episodes per 10,000 dives. So if you had a five-fold increase, okay, that would be 10 per 10,000 or one in 1,000. So you have a situation that occurs in 25% of people and an illness that would still only occur one in 1,000 times. That's why we don't screen for this routinely. However, there are certain people who we will screen for. We'll talk about how to screen for in a second. And there are four types of decompression illness that are felt to be associated with PFO. Those are cerebral symptoms, so stroke-like symptoms, spinal decompression illness, which would be either paralysis or urinary retention, inner ear symptoms, which would be vertigo, or skin bends. So if you just had if people came up and had an isolated joint pain, a type 1 bend, and they were found to have a PFO for some reason, or they knew they had a PFO, that's probably true and unrelated. Whereas if people had cerebral hits or recurrent skin bends, then took a spinal hit, those are the people that'd be a big red flag that you'd be worried about having a PFO. So the way we test for that, there's three tests that have been done historically. One is called a transcranial Doppler, and then two forms of ultrasound, either a transthoracic echocardiogram or a transesophageal echocardiogram. Currently, the feeling is that a transthoracic echocardiogram with a bubble study is the treatment of, is the test of choice. What that is an echo from the chest wall, as opposed to the TE, which is down the throat, so it's a much less invasive procedure. It allows imaging of the heart, so you can tell exactly where the shunt is. With a transcranial Doppler, you just know there is a shunt somewhere, but don't isolate it very well. But with an echo, you do have to have a bubble study. A regular echo, you're not going to pick it up, or at least you may not pick it up. And we do injection of these agitated saline, and the ultrasound waves will bounce off the bubbles, allow us to see them and see if they cross over the atrial septum. It's also important to do maneuvers because, again, this is a dynamic situation, so we'll usually do that at rest. Then we'll have the patient's Valsalva, or we'll press on their belly or have them sniff or something like that to change the loading conditions, and sometimes that'll unmask a significant PFO.
So you have a PFO. You've been tested. It's objective. It's there. What are the treatment options?
Okay. There are anytime you have had recurrent. First off, if you've had a PFO and never had a symptom, you don't need to do anything. You just dive to your heart's content. I wouldn't worry about that.
Right.
However, if you have had recurrent decompression illness and you've been found to have a recurrent decompression illness of the types I talked about that are associated with a PFO, and you're then found to have a PFO, you have one of three options. The first option is you can stop diving. Okay. I would imagine that most people listening to this podcast and all the patients that show up in my office don't choose that option, okay? But that is an option. If you don't dive, you don't have to worry about that. The second option is what's called diving conservatively, and the way that has been defined in the literature is diving shallower than 100 feet, doing no decompression diving, using nitrox, but diving your computer set to air, but not exceeding your MOD, doing long safety stops, no more than one or two dives per day, and doing no strong physical activity for several hours after diving. And that has been studied and has been shown to decrease the risk of recurrent decompression illness, because the issue is not the PFO. The issue is the inert gas load. So anything you do to lessen the inert gas load, whether or not you have a PFO, is going to lessen your likelihood of having decompression illness. So things like shorter dives, shallower dives, fewer dives per day, long safety stops, all that, what it's doing is decreasing the inert gas load, and that'll decrease the likelihood of having a problem. The third option, so if you have someone who says, I've got a PFO, I've had recurrent decompression illness, I don't want to stop diving, I've already tried the things that you talked about, and I'm still having problems, then that's the select population that we would consider PFO closure. PFO closure is a very benign procedure. It's got a very high safety record, very high success rate, very low complication rate, but it is an invasive procedure. So we don't just offer it to everybody. It's a select group of people. It's an outpatient procedure done through a needle stick in the leg. It's not surgery. It takes about 30 minutes to an hour to perform. It's a little clamshell device that you put one disc on the left side of the flap, one disc on the right side of the flap, and it kind of clamshells the thing together. Your body will then just kind of heal that over time. We usually send people home the same day. They go home on aspirin and Plavix, which like people with heart stents would go home on. And the reason for that is we don't want any kind of clots to form on the device while it's healing. So most cardiologists will send people home on aspirin and Plavix for 3 to 6 months. And with diving, the recommendation is at 3 months after the procedure, the recommendation is to get another echocardiogram with another bubble study. If that now no longer shows any bubbles crossing the septum, they can return to diving with no restrictions.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Thank you. So let's talk about a common heart rhythm disturbance, atrial fibrillation. What is atrial fibrillation?
Okay, if you think back to, again, back to biology class, your heart has these four chambers. What's supposed to happen is the two top chambers contract simultaneously to fill the two bottom chambers. The two bottom chambers then contract simultaneously to pump the blood. That's that lub-dub thing that's going on. What happens with atrial fibrillation is the top chambers will begin to quiver, and they quiver both electrically and mechanically. When they're quivering electrically, they can be firing off impulses to the bottom chambers at up to 300 beats a minute. Luckily, the wiring of the heart won't usually take 300 beats a minute, but in some people, it can take 160 and make it feel like your heart's coming out of your chest. Okay, so one aspect of treatment of atrial fibrillation is slowing things down so that people aren't, it's not as rapid. So we have medications to slow things down. You can also control the rate and the rhythm with medications. So there are true rhythm stabilizing medications as well as rate controlling medications. And then there's procedures for people, what's called atrial fibrillation ablation, which is again done through a needle stick to try and control the rhythm that way. So all those are ways to control the rhythm.
Right.
So all that's on the rhythm side. The other side that's a problem is that when the top chambers are literally quivering and not contracting, blood up there can get stagnant. Blood that gets stagnant can form clots. Clots can then go bad places like strokes. So the major concern from a medical standpoint with atrial fibrillation is the increased risk of stroke. And in fact, having atrial fibrillation increases your stroke risk about fivefold. It could be that you have a very, very low risk of stroke. So if you increase it by fivefold, it's still very, very low and wouldn't justify the bleeding risks with long-term blood thinners. Or it could be that you've got a pretty significant risk of stroke baseline and developing atrial fibrillation and multiplying that number by five makes it a huge risk of stroke.
Absolutely.
So we have a scoring system that we use. It's what's called a CHADS-VASc score, which uses things like age, gender, and other medical problems to allow us to decide who would benefit from long-term blood thinners.
So can a diver who is adequately treated with atrial fibrillation dive again?
Absolutely. The two aspects of whether or not to return to diving are, one, how well-controlled the rhythm is. If it is fairly well-controlled, so people are not having a lot of symptoms, the rate, then people can return to diving from that standpoint. So you'd want to make sure that the rate is controlled and not having – they're not incapacitated when they go into this rhythm. And then the second issue is the blood thinners. And blood thinners are felt to be a relative contraindication diving, meaning that that's kind of a case-by-case basis. If you're on blood thinners, are you more likely to bleed? Yes. That is usually a nuisance bleed as opposed to a life-threatening bleed. You could be at increased risk of either barotrauma bleeding or physical trauma bleeding. When I say barotrauma, I mean if you were to have sinus issues, you'd more likely bleed into that problem. Or if you had trouble clearing your ears and you strained to clear your ears, you may be more likely to bleed into the middle ear. That's a nuisance problem. It's not likely to be a life-threatening problem, but a concern. Physical trauma. So if you were to be bitten by something, you bleed more than if you weren't, or you scraped yourself on a wreck, you bleed more. But again, that's not likely to be a life-threatening problem in and of itself. The one theoretical concern, which needs to be discussed with patients, is that there's a theoretical concern that, let's say, you suffered decompression illness and you had a bad one. You had a type 2 hit in your brain. It would be reasonable to think that you would be more likely to bleed into that injured area if you're on blood thinners than if you were not. We don't say it would necessarily happen, but you'd probably be higher risk of that. And if that were to occur, that would be a much more severe episode than if it didn't occur. So for every patient, they need to decide what is their tolerance, risk tolerance for that theoretical concern to happen.
Right, and I suppose it would be important for that diver to be able to speak to a physician who's knowledgeable in dive medicine to really have a better understanding of that.
Absolutely. So, but that's kind of where the decision points are in that kind of a...
In general, then as a cardiologist, how do you advise divers who are on chronic medications regarding their fitness to dive? Is it the medication they're on that concerns you, or is it the reason they're on the medication, their medical problem?
Right. If you call the Dan or helpline and ask a question, can I dive on this medication? The major issue is, why are you on that medication? Most medications have not really been studied in a hyperbaric environment, so we don't really know what the effect of the medicine would be at several atmospheres of pressure versus the surface. But the main problem is why people are taking it. In other words, if someone were to say, can I dive on Dilantin, which, as you know, is an anti-seizure medicine, the problem is not the Dilantin, it's the fact that they have a seizure disorder.
Right.
So same thing would go if they say, can I dive on my Entresto, which is a medication for severe heart failure. The Entresto is probably not the problem. It's probably the fact that they've got a very, very weakened heart muscle is the major issue. So again, something to discuss with Dan or discuss with your physician. So the main issue is not the medications themselves, but the medical condition leading to you being on those medications.
Well, Dr. Ebersole, this has been really great. I want to thank you for participating in today's conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation.
Dr. Douglas Ebersole, cardiologist and technical diving instructor, thank you so much for this invaluable conversation on heart fitness and diving. This is Dr. David Charish, dive medicine physician from Dive Medicine and Hyperbaric Consultants, looking forward to our next conversation on our podcast, Fitness to Diving.